He's not even a lawyer and he's kicking your ass.
No! Bad lawyer! I need a loophole!
He's not Judge Judy, an executioner!
He is!
Sorry, but my mother always said if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all.
Will that hold up in court?
No, I've tried it before.
Stop. Ask a question a lawyer would ask, please.
I am a lawyer.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 383. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew. How are you doing, Andrew?
I'm fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
I'm good. I can't wait. I feel like I'm looking at our schedule here. Andrew, I'm looking at the whiteboard, as you call it, the spreadsheet, and this doesn't look like a happy episode. This looks like a very depressing episode.
But. Yeah, this is we've done a happy face episode before. This is a frowny face episode.
Yeah, but it's, we need to know just exactly how this administration is screwing us so that we can, you know, maybe factor that in when you're thinking both sides are the same or something. Maybe factor that in. Okay. Yeah. We're going to talk about, you know, you made a prediction after the 2018 midterm when we won back the House. You said we would see Trump's tax returns. And so
I sure did. So let's talk about that.
So I assume you have them. OK, well, you'll go through breaking. No, that would be a big story. So we're going to talk about a recent decision related to that. And then we're, as promised, we're going to go more in depth about the horrible abuse that big companies are basically the corruption involved or whatever you would call it, them raiding the money that was meant for small businesses, right?
This is solely within the money allocated for big businesses, but it is about the potential for rampant corruption that maybe I was a little overly optimistic about on my first swing at taking a look at the CARES Act. So
gotcha.
It's how we can stay vigilant on that. If you want an optimistic take, right, knowing about this helps us, you know, knowing is half the battle. And so,
yeah. I will get into it, but I would assume that, again, there's going to be so much to fix. This is why the political theory of let a rabid, you know, idiot raccoon run the government for 4 years, because then ultimately you'll get your like super progressive stuff later. That it's an idiotic theory because you don't have the courts, you don't have anything. There's so much to fix that you can never get back to where you were. But anyway,
I mean, the only problem with that theory is it's unconnected to history, and it requires you to ignore the fact that judicial appointments are for life and that staffing executive agencies matters. So, you know, it's the flip side of the point that you made that I wish we'd had more time to like dwell on it. But we were talking about the implementation legislation, the implementation regulations for SBA loans. Right. And I read you a section of the CFR and you're like, wait, that excludes like pyramid schemes and payday lenders and religious institutions.
Everything that
Trump loves. Right. Yeah. Why hasn't and you said basically like, well, why hasn't he, you know, overwritten that yet? And the answer is because the CFR is huge, right? Like it's I'm sure it's on his list to, you know, overwrite at some point. But like,
well, and I held back, too, because I was, you know, we were out of time, but I wanted to ask you like, well, you know, all these different deferences, like that's got to factor in, right?
Yep.
Won't there be a Chevron deference and an hour deference way of like the judiciary just rewriting these rules somehow?
It's a good question. And this is going to take us down a rabbit trail. We cannot go down this episode. But the lasting point that I want to be clear about is if we elect a Democratic president, right? Like Even the even at, you know, a Sanders Warren administration 4 years in is still going to have not undone all the harm that Trump has done, just because there's so much work to do. Right.
Yeah.
In the same way that Trump has not yet undone
build
everything.
Something back up than it is to just ruin something.
Yeah,
it's much easier again to be an idiot raccoon running around trashing everything is much easier than fixing things.
Exactly.
So anyway, sorry, it's just so frustrating. But what the point I was trying to make was, this will be something like we do want to know, as the G.I. Joe knowing is half the battle or something. We do want to know, because also if we, you know, we can try to fix this stuff if we get rid of Trump, like we can start, maybe there will be some way of getting some of this money back from these corrupt companies that are stealing it, possibly, right?
Yes. Okay. So,
so there you have it. All right. That was, you know, we didn't have any announcements for you, so that'll take the place of announcements. Now let's get to those segments as I
angry informed rant to begin.
Yeah.
There
angry
you go.
Informed rant.
Ms. Vito, please answer the question. Does the defense's case hold water?
No.
Andrew
is wrong.
Are you sure?
I'm positive.
Okay, first segment. Possibly, now you haven't called this an Andrew is wrong.
Oh, we could call this an Andrew is wrong. You can label that right on the whiteboard right now with a big AWW. Well,
I'll join you. You know, oftentimes I like to just watch as the crowd just chants, Andrew's wrong. And I'm like, yeah, see, he was wrong. No, but I'll join you because you made the point that it didn't seem like the Supreme Court or Roberts or, you know, would want to like go out on a limb to protect Trump's tax returns. It, you know, as conservative of hacks as they are, they're no longer really accountable to Trump in any meaningful way. They don't stand for re-election. They don't, you know, they're on the Supreme Court for life. So having said all that, I was right there with you, but it sounds like SCOTUS has handed Trump a minor victory here.
Yeah. And let's unpack that a little bit, because I want to give sort of the full mea culpa, right? The law is 100% clear that the IRS was required to turn over Trump's taxes to the House Committee on Finance, right? Like it did not occur to me that we would have the most corrupt attorney general in U.S. history, and that you would establish this norm in the second half of Trump's first term, whereby Trump appointees are just like, oh, well, I'm not going to follow the law because no harm is going to come to me. That is perhaps the most horrifying long-term consequence of the Trump administration, is this notion that, like, well, I can just put my people in charge and tell them to disobey the law and nothing can happen as a result. That's terrifying. That is going to relate to this segment on a more specific level as well, because when that happens, right, when the executive branch tells, right, when the head of the executive branch tells a subordinate to defy the law, your remedy is to go to the courts, right? That's where we go. And so part of my bold prediction post the midterm elections that we were going to see Trump's tax returns in 2019, about which I was wrong, was that you not only had a clear law, but you had so many different avenues, right? Like, you had the federal statute that required the IRS to turn over the information to Congress, didn't expect the IRS director to defy the law. And you had private subpoenas out to institutions like Deutsche Bank and Mazars LLP, the accounting firm, requiring them to turn over Trump's tax returns to congressional inquiries. And I figured, sort of as between clear law and clear subpoena authority, something would get through. And like Trump being elected, right, he sort of managed to thread the needle and, you know, roll nothing but sixes on, you know, multiple times in a row to protect his tax returns from being released. I want to first take a step back and explain part of why this matters, that will sort of tie together this entire episode. And it's this, right? The elephant in the room, right? Our president's fortune, the part that was not made by being a game show host, is from hotels, casinos, resorts, golf courses, you know, all of these things that are closed right now for good reason. And so if Donald Trump weren't the president, right, it would be perfectly reasonable to say, we need to figure out like how to make sure how to protect these kinds of businesses from being steamrollered by the COVID-19 crisis, right? Because people aren't going to play golf. People aren't staying in hotels. People aren't going to casinos, right? In every sensible state, these are mandatorily shut down by force of law, right? So when I read a report that Donald Trump was going to his lenders to ask for some kind of relief on loan obligations, on the one hand, right, on the steel man side of the equation, you would say, sure, right? If I owned a casino, I would be going to my lender and being like, come on, man, like, I get it. Casino's a license to print money, but not when everyone is locked down, right?
Sure.
The problem is that Donald Trump is the president. And
yeah, I think he'll be fine.
It's not just that he's going to be fine. It is you do not want the president as a supplicant to a multinational corporation saying, hey, I need you to do me a favor, though, because there is only one reason why an institution like Deutsche Bank is going to do the president a favor. And it is not because of patriotic love of the United States. You can probably guess that just by the name of the company. So this report comes out that Donald Trump has gone to Deutsche Bank, of whom we know about $2 billion in indebtedness, right? So lots of money. And so as a result, on April 7th, my girlfriend, Elizabeth Warren, and three other Democratic senators.
You're going to have to fight that Marine, but okay.
I'm open-minded, where me and the Marine and Liz Warren are in a polycule right now. And of those three senators, by the way, I also can lay claim to one of the other three senators, who's Chris Van Hollen, who is my senator. So anyway, so Liz Warren, one of four Democratic senators, sent a letter to Deutsche Bank that said this look, you know, that referenced the report that I just described and said, it's real bad if the president is seeking favors from you. So we want you to produce three categories of documents. We want you to produce since the beginning of the year, right, all of your communications between Deutsche Bank and the Trump org related to loan repayments or communications about those, right? That was category one. Category two, all of those with any of the with the Kushner companies, right, the holding company. And then third, we want for the quo part of the quid pro quo, we want all of your communications with the White House regarding any legislative, regulatory, or enforcement matters related to Deutsche Bank. So these are, as you would expect, any good lawyer, and Elizabeth Warren is a brilliant lawyer. These are appropriate, narrowly tailored document requests related to a perfectly reasonable inquiry from the Senate Financial Services Committee. Requested those documents on or before April 21st. On April 21st, you want to take a wild guess as to Deutsche Bank's reply?
No, I don't know.
Yeah. Go clown horn yourself, right? It was like, sorry. We have a confidential relationship with our client. We're not going to produce it unless you make us. And that then relates to efforts to make them. In particular, we have the longstanding lawsuits related to congressional subpoenas issued in early 2018 to Deutsche Bank and to Mazars requesting Trump's taxes, which are now consolidated and pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. And again, Deutsche Bank like took a we try and steel man the other side as much as possible. Deutsche Bank took, I think, a more defensible position with respect to those subpoenas, which was basically like, look, we're stuck here because the president has told us to shut up and Congress is telling us to talk. As soon as we know which side is right as a matter of law, we'll comply.
If only there's a clear law that obviously
right.
would.
Yeah, well, I know. But but nevertheless, right, like it's fair, right? Like, again, you know, I try and you try and steal me on the other mm-hmm. side. I have represented large companies before back when I was in the big firm world. And, you know, you can see telling a company like, hey, I don't know that you want to risk defying a direct instruction from the president of the United States. And, you know, that's a fair position to take. So those cases have been appealed all the way up to the Supreme Court. They are pending. They have been briefed. Oral argument is scheduled for May 12th in those cases. With oral argument being scheduled for May 12th, it means it's possible that the Supreme Court could rule before the election, but there is zero chance that the Supreme Court will actually rule before the election. And then 2 days ago, as I am paging through.
You're saying that means they've run out the clock.
They have run out the clock. Wow. That is correct. Which, again, is another component of my being wrong that I didn't think was possible.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court just did a thing. This is buried on page 7 of the minute orders in pending cases. That I happen to read because I read this sort of stuff and I look for deny. This is before like 5 pages of denials of cert, denials for petitions for rehearing, denials of habeas corpus petitions. This is truly like the kind of stuff only I read. Right. And it is consolidated in the Trump and Mazars cases. It is a particular 2-line order, which I will read in its entirety. But first, I want to tell you, before I describe the order, how terrible Trump's arguments are in these cases. Okay. Again, this is a brief written by Jay Sekulow, the dumbest lawyer in America. So I'm not surprised that the brief is terrible and the arguments are terrible. But even for Jay Sekulow, this brief is terrible and these arguments are awful. Okay. And the arguments are that Congress does not have the authority to issue subpoenas requesting the president's tax returns. And in the alternative, that even if they do, that these particular subpoenas do not have a legitimate legislative purpose. It is a 65-page brief. It makes those two arguments. You could refute those two arguments in a page and a half because they are stupid and terrible and wrong. It is 100% clear as a matter of law that Congress has subpoena power. They have broad, wide-ranging subpoena power, and that the courts have consistently since the 18th century, since the founding of the country, said that we defer to Congress in terms of what a legislative purpose is. And you have, again, this sort of ties the whole episode together, right? You could not have a more clear example of the legislative reason for needing this than crafting relief to the hotel, casino, resort, and golf course industries, right? Like, you need to know what secretive business interest the president has in figuring out how to craft regulations that does not allow the sitting president of the United States to loot private, you know, taxpayer dollars that are being allocated to bail out people who aren't the president of the United States. These arguments are terrible and stupid and bad, and I was confident, slightly less so, but confident that would at least shame Justice Roberts enough that we would get at least a 5-4 order requiring these two private entities to turn over Trump's tax returns to Congress.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And here's where I get to be wrong again, or potentially wrong. This is the text of the order. It says, the parties and the Solicitor General are directed to file supplemental letter briefs addressing whether the political question doctrine or related justiciability principles bear on the court's adjudication of these cases. The briefs, not to exceed 15 pages, are to be filed simultaneously with the clerk and served upon opposing counsel on or before 2 p.m. Friday, May 8th, 2020. Right? So a week from now, or a week from last Friday. I want to tell you what this is. This is the conservative howler monkey contingent of the Supreme Court looking at these briefs and going, holy clown horn, even I can't vote for this. This is so bad and so stupid that it does not pass the Brett Kavanaugh test. It does not pass the Sam Alito test. Because that argument, I told you 65-page brief to make two terrible arguments. That argument is an argument about standing, right? It says that the court does not have standing to adjudicate this claim because it's non-justiciable. It is a political controversy. You solve it by electing a president who does disclose his tax returns, right? This is what the court did.
Well, I don't blame Jay Sekulow for trying, because lately it's been, oh, this is not like voter suppression, gerrymandering. Can't justish. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, and so this is my point, right? That's right. That the Supreme Court greatly expanded the non-justiciability doctrine on political questions to include gerrymandering, which required John Roberts to sign on to an opinion that Sam Alito wrote with a straight face that said the solution to gerrymandered electoral districts that deprive you of your vote is to vote. Like it's astonishing. It will go down as one of the worst opinions, when we're still doing this show 30 years from now and we look back at part two of our Hall of Shame, that absolutely will belong in the Hall of Shame. This is the conservative wing of the court going, hey, you didn't argue X, but we'd like you to have argued X. And now will you argue X for us?
Jeez.
And it is absolutely throwing a life preserver saying, we'd like to rule that this is non-justiciable. So write that up so that then we can say that question was presented to us, even though you did not present that question to us. It is appalling. And let me make a very, very simple and straightforward prediction. If Donald Trump is reelected, he will win on non-justiciability grounds. If Donald Trump is not reelected, he will lose 5-4. And Roberts will be the swing vote, and he will not cast his decision until after the November election, until after he decides. Now, again, they may also decline even to think about it and say, well, you know, it's possible that this will be mooted. I think it plainly will not be mooted, because you were talking about an ongoing request for information that aids the House of Representatives in crafting legislation to prevent any future president from doing this. But I feel, again, this is an Andrew was wrong segment. I'm doubling down, right? Double or nothing, that's how this is going to come out. If you care about transparency in government, if you care about winning on this issue, you better hope that Trump loses, because this Supreme Court has thrown a lifeline to the dumbest lawyer in America who happens to represent the president of the United States and said, hey, you should have argued this thing, don't you think? And again,
can't they just email each other, like, save us the whole charade?
Yep. It is no point have they argued that this is a non-justiciable federal question. The only mention of standing is in a procedural history and that bears on sort of the separation of powers issues is in footnote 7 on pages 59 to 60 of a 65-page brief. It's not an argument that was there, and it's an argument that the Supreme Court, that the right wing of the Supreme Court has crafted to give themselves cover to intervene to protect this president in the event that he wins re-election. Don't let them do that.
Okay.
There you go. Well, I'm now convinced. We're done. but otherwise, it's going to be real bad.
Okay. Yeah. This is now that's part one of our bad episode, our unhappy face episode. Let's get to our main segment, which is about more PPP abuse. Opening Arguments is brought to you by Hims. Folks, I've talked about Hims a lot. I've talked about how there are some medical problems and issues that you don't really want to have to go into the doctor's office for. Least of all now, by the way, even more so now. But even under the best of circumstances, there are certain health issues that it's just easier to be able to do it online, whether it's hair loss or erectile dysfunction. And 40% of men by age 40 struggle from not being able to get and maintain an erection. So why do guys turn to weird solutions or do nothing when they can turn to medicine and science? Again, not gas station supplements. This is prescription solutions. So 4hims.com is your one-stop shop for hair loss, skin care, and sexual wellness for men. They connect you with real licensed doctors and FDA-approved pharmaceutical products to treat ED. These are well-known generic equivalents to name-brand prescriptions to help you combat ED, and they are prescription solutions backed by science, as I said. So stop worrying about having to go to the doctor, multiple in-office visits. You know, it's embarrassing. It's much easier to be able to go on 4hims.com/opening and answer some quick questions about your medical history and chat with a doctor for a confidential review. And if you're approved by the doctor, the products are shipped directly to your door. Being your best means performing your best. So try Hims today by starting out with a free online visit. Go to 4hims.com/opening. That's forhims.com/opening. 4hims.com/opening. Prescription products are subject to a doctor approval and require an online consultation with a physician who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. See website for full details and safety information. This could cost hundreds if you went in person to the doctor's office or pharmacy. Remember, that's 4hims.com/opening.
In Friday's episode, we talked about the Paycheck Protection Program component of the CARES Act. That was set aside for small companies, despite the fact that large companies decided to get their noses in at the trough. I want to talk about the other area of cash handouts in the CARES Act, and that is the Title IV of the Act, what we called the slush fund back in episode 372, and where we sort of focused our efforts because it was a larger amount of money and it was going to big companies regardless. Those are the ones that tend to have sophisticated lobbyists and members of Congress that do their bidding, even in both parties. And that's the one that's overseen by Steve Mnuchin, who qualifies as a grown-up in the Trump administration, despite the fact that OA listeners know he proceeded with destroying Kmart to get enough to buy Sears to then loot Sears. And that's the fox you want guarding this hen house. But I want to delve into a section of this that I missed. And I want to tell you how bad it is, because it's real bad. And I want to give a shout out to my buddy George Delta, who emailed me about this and said, I think you missed this. And so he's right. I mean, in fairness to me, like, he emailed me 3 weeks after we did our episode. So, you know, like, I think I did a good job with, 6 hours notice. But nevertheless, it's important that we go back and make sure that we're fly specking all of the myriad provisions in this 880 page bill that, that we accurately summarized for you, but didn't completely. So the slush fund, how does it? So first, what I want to do is kind of break down how it works. And it works similarly to the PPP programs. This is section 4003B4. And
I think it's if I know anything, it's mainly like The Godfather, where there's the wedding, and then they all come to Steve Mnuchin, and they ask him for a favor on this day of his daughter's wedding.
Yeah, it's kind of like that. So, yeah. So of the $500 billion, $454 billion is earmarked. Quote: "It shall be available to make loans and loan guarantees to, and other investments in, programs or facilities established by the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System for the purposes of providing liquidity to the financial system that supports lending to eligible businesses." Now, that's a crazy level of convoluted legalese, and I'm going to explain the importance of that in a second. But then it basically
sounded like we want investors to have money. And then the reasoning is, well, because they provide liquidity for other people.
Yeah. And then here's how that then is specified. This is I stopped at businesses. That's actually a comma. But I felt like I needed to say, yeah. I needed to break down the first half, the second half, but still the same sentence. Eligible businesses, states or municipalities by A, purchasing obligations or other interests directly from issuers of such obligations or other interests. B, purchasing obligations or other interests in secondary markets or otherwise. Or C, making loans, including loans or other advances secured by collateral. So put all of that together. That's an incredibly broad purpose clause, as you just saw. And it's necessary because this is the Fed, right? This is the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. And without this law, the Fed can only buy debt instruments that are either issued by the federal government, right? Things like treasury bonds, right? Or guaranteed, expressly guaranteed by the federal government, right? And think about like federal student loans, mortgages that are guaranteed by Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, right? And that makes sense, right? You don't want the Fed out there just buying ordinary loans, right? Particularly that subsection B, buying loans off the secondary market. So what the structure does is empowers, this is that other investments in programs established by, that's something that elsewhere in the IRS code are referred to as special purpose vehicles, SPVs. So put it all together, 4003B4 says that the Board of Governors of the Fed can create SPVs, and those SPVs can then go out and buy loans that otherwise the Fed would be prohibited from buying. Okay? Then the very next section, that was 4003B, 4003C, contains the restrictions on what those vehicles can buy. You can't, and this was publicly the result of some negotiation with Democrats, right? So this got some media attention. Section C, 3, capital A, little Roman numeral 2. So C3A2 says you can't use it for a stock buyback, right? And this is what I would call the Mnuchin rule. And I love the Democratic senator that managed to get this one in there. A publicly traded company that receives any of these loans cannot pay dividends during the period of the loan and for 12 months thereafter, right? Mm. So the reason I call that the Mnuchin rule is, right, you can't do what Mnuchin did to Sears. You can't say, oh, well, we're going to get huge loan and we're either going to buy back our stock or we're going to issue dividends to stockholders.
Side note, I love that it's just common knowledge that Mnuchin totally ripped off, like ruined a company and profited off of it. Yeah. And it's total fraud and everything. It's just it's out there. Everybody knows it, or at least, you know, some the
senators. OA listeners know it. Yeah.
Yeah. OA listeners. Hey, because we literally have what's the phrase? The something guarding the hen house? What is the fox?
Fox. Garden? Yeah.
Yeah. We've literally got a fox here who did this before. Let's put in a little rule to try to stop the, even though there's no like, let's take this guy should be in jail, this guy should not be running large parts of our government. Nope, he's there.
Yep. This is what we thought the best we could do was. And now, mind you, I did know, we've not gotten to the provision that I didn't cover. I knew and covered this, and I knew that That was subsection two. Subsection three allows Mnuchin to waive that requirement. This is on page 519, if you want to follow along in the CARES Act at home. But in order to issue a waiver, it must be, now this part is nonsense, right? Upon a determination that such a waiver is necessary to protect the interests of the federal government. Well, you know, that means nothing. But it then says, if you do so, the secretary shall testify before the House Committee on Financial Services, right? And shall means, again, this overlaps with the first segment, you can probably get mandamus, right? When it says you shall do something, if a government official doesn't do that thing, ordinarily you can go to the courts and be like, hey, make them do the thing. That's what Marbury versus Madison was all about, right? Like, that's been the definition of mandamus since the founding fathers, unless John Roberts decides that this is a non-justiciable political question. But I thought that was at least some level of protection. We flagged it, right? We said, look, like, the disqualifying reference, you know, for example, prohibits you from owning or controlling these companies and, you know, prohibits Jared Kushner. But it doesn't mean that a company that Jared Kushner owns 49% of isn't going to be eligible for these loans. And of course, you know, that you know, all of these pigs at the trough are going to get, you know, the money is going to go to Jared Kushner, is going to go to Donald and Ivanka Trump. And of course it is, right? You know, we thought there was some protection there. Here's what I missed, and it is section 4009, and this is really, really bad. It begins on page 535. So again, for those of you playing the home version, and now let me explain. This is a tiny bit of a rabbit trail that I need to go down to explain the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is supposed to be a nonpartisan government entity. You know, it's like a lot of these, like the CFPB, the terms are staggered and are designed to go beyond a presidential administration. So, you know, the Fed is supposed to be nonpartisan and independent of the executive branch in as much as an executive branch agency can be. And of course, the Fed isn't right now because Trump has broken it. And the way Trump has broken it is by firing, threatening to fire, or driving Democratic commissioners on the Federal Reserve to resign. And in fact, threatening to fire the only remaining Republican that Trump himself did not appoint, and the guy whom Trump elevated to be the chair, Jay Powell. So, you know, this is supposed to be an independent agency, and it isn't. It's supposed to have 7 members. It only has 5 right now. And of those 5, 4 are Republicans and 3 are Trump appointees. Only 1 is a Democrat, Lael Brainard. And the pending nominees, you're going to love this, include Judy Shelton.
Justin Walker. He's getting on that, too.
Yeah, right. You might as well at this point. Judy Shelton, who... Google Judy Shelton if you got, you know, look, you got nothing but spare time right now. So when this episode is over, dear listener, Google Judy Shelton and then do not sue opening arguments for the traumatic brain injury that you will cause yourself banging your head against the desk when you read about this person. She worked for Ben Carson's campaign. Okay, that's fine. She thinks we should return to the gold standard because she's a crazy person. And she's basically called the Federal Reserve a Ponzi scheme. So, yeah, she is.
That's who I want in charge of the
Federal Reserve. Yeah, the person who thinks that the entire system is nonsense. You know, is said, you know, why we don't need a federal bank, which I guess, you know, if you're going to. You know, you're going to litigate for a return to the gold standard and, you know, abolishing the federal bank. I mean, you know, it would fit right at home in 1811 politics. Although kind of weird because, you know, Judy. So, you know, she would have not had the right to vote or appear in public in 1811 America. But, you know, whatever. So she's Peach. And at some point she's going to be on the Federal Reserve. But right now it is 4-1 Republican. And it's 3-2 Trump appointees to non-Trump appointees. So, you know, essentially, and look,
how does it go so far in a mere 3.5 years or whatever, is it?
Because Trump fired Janet Yellen and induced the other Democrats to quit.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Can we do that the other way?
You know, that sure would be fun, wouldn't it? Look, I haven't done deep research into the three Trump appointees. All I know about them is they were appointed by Donald Trump. But here's what they can do. Under Section 4009, subsection A. And again, you can understand why this escaped my notice the first time around. It says, if the chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System determines, that's Jay Powell, determines in writing that unusual and exigent circumstances exist, right? And exigent just means of immediate concern. The board may conduct meetings without regard to the section, to the requirements of Section 552B of Title V of the U.S. Code. And then that ends either one, when the national emergency declared by the president on March 13th, 2020 ends, or at the end of the calendar year, December 31st, 2020, whichever comes first. And so the right question is, what the hell is 5 U.S.C. Section 552B? And the answer to that is, that's the Sunshine Act. That requires that government agencies, when they meet, do so in public with records kept, and that those records, and then the cross section to that, that those records be produced in response to FOIA requests. So put all of this together, and what this means is that if the Trump-controlled Federal Reserve Board decides that unusual circumstances exist, with respect to doling out any of these loans, they can meet in a private session that does not have to be open to the public. Now, nothing is open to the public right now, but they do not have to keep records of that meeting other than a vote on the ultimate disposition of how to award the funds. So literally, the three Trump appointees can be like, oh, well, this is Jared Kushner's company. He owns 49% of it. Let's give them $100 million. And we will never find out if that happens. I have never seen a provision like this in a law before. I am terrified that this made it into this law. It means that we need to do a couple of things, right? The first is it absolutely means that we need to have that we need to petition our elected representatives to amend the CARE Act, the CARES Act. We need to be talking about this, and we need to be on the lookout. Just control F every time proposed legislation comes up between now and the end of this national nightmare, just do a control F for 552 lowercase b. 55552 is enough, right?
You hear that, Congress?
Yeah. Look for 5 USC 552B within legislation because this is a provision that says the people making the decision do not have to do so in public, do not have to leave a paper trail. And that's going to make it all the more critical that the press do serious quality investigative reporting, because usually you're backstopped by the government having to produce records or tell you they're not producing the records, at least, right? And here, there will not be records. And this is exactly the kind of thing there needs to be records. Right. This is doling out $500 billion to the largest, most powerful corporate interests in America. And again, it fits with our theme of the past forever continuing into the indefinite future, at least into the first Tuesday after the first full week in November. However corporatist or bad you think any particular Democrat is, Democrats don't do this. This is what Republicans do to ensure that corrupt financial decisions are made in secret and this should terrify you, and it terrifies me. So happy Tuesday, everybody.
Cool. What a fun episode.
I know, it's
almost like we need to fix this in the ballot box.
Yeah.
Best we can.
And
best
we can. And look, I promise we have worked really hard. We did, you know, the interview with the Knowledge Fight guys and with Devin over at Legal Legal. We got more coming your way. We are trying not to make this terrible and funereal and awful. I'd like to think we've done a good job at that. All of us are having issues, and I know that this is a tough time, but I feel like it is my responsibility to inform you about this. And there's no way to sugarcoat this one. There's no way to Optimist Prime it. This is a terrible, terrible section. And you know, we're not powerless to stop it, but like, you know, it should inform you from a decision-making perspective, and nobody's talking about it. So we got to talk about it. So there you go.
I just hope there's some sort of either, whether it's going to be like a nonprofit or maybe even some sort of committee, you know, congressional committee or something. Assuming, by the way, this is all on the assumption that we vote Trump out. Cause if we don't, nothing, it's just going to get far worse. Republicans will know they can get away with anything. Trump will know he can get away with anything. It's the end. Like if we don't vote Trump out, it's going to be incredibly long and difficult to recover from this. But assuming we vote him out in however many 7 months or whatever it is, 6 months, I hope there's just some level of investigation and accounting into like all of these things, like how much money was looted from our government by you know, Trump and Trump crony connected companies, and like how many government agencies have been ruined and to what extent. And it just, there's so much. Doesn't it feel like there's just too much damage to even, you know, quantify? It feels overwhelming.
I completely agree. And I want to go a step further, right? Which is in one of the things that I think was a mistake by Barack Obama, I understand it at the time, was his sort of declaration. And again, during the primary and during the general election, that he would not pursue investigations regarding the Iraq war and regarding the Bush administration ranging all the way up to the question as to whether high-ranking Bush administration officials committed war crimes by knowingly fabricating information before the United Nations. I didn't agree with that decision. I thought that should be on the table. I criticized Obama at the time. We didn't have OA, but I would have criticized him on OA if we'd have had OA.
And even if you thought that might have been the right thing to do at the time, I think history tells us it wasn't.
Obviously.
And also, yeah.
We
can try to learn from that and realize absolutely do not make that same mistake this time.
Yeah, around. And that's right. That's where I'm going with that, which is, look, I get there's a, you know, we've got to heal, like blah, blah, blah. But we have to hold these criminals accountable. And I think, and again, right, I think it would be perfectly reasonable to withhold donating money to the Biden campaign. Look, you got to go out and vote Democrat no matter what. That's the position of this podcast. We've said it a million times. You know where we are. I think it would be reasonable to go to a Biden town hall, a virtual town hall now, and for the foreseeable future, and say, you know, what's your position on holding Trump and members of his administration accountable for crimes? And if you don't get an unambiguous yes to say, okay, I don't know that I can, I don't know that I can donate. I don't know that I can volunteer. I don't know that I can lick envelopes. I say that because I think the Biden campaign would provide a positive answer to that question, but it's worth asking and should be asked. And we don't lose all leverage over Biden, in this process. We've talked about it. We talked about it on last Friday's episode, you know, how to make sure that the party platform reflects progressive values, which I believe it will. And I think, to me, this is a clear one, right? This is a clear, like, you gotta be on board with saying that the people who broke our system will be held accountable for it.
Well, and if it makes anybody, I don't know, maybe feel better, I think the Biden presidency is going to be far more about who he has around him than it is about him.
Oh, of course. You know? Yeah.
He's a million years old. Yeah. You know, like there's, and I have quite a bit of faith, not 100%, but quite a bit of faith that he will put good people around him. He will have good, you know, a good cabinet, a good, you know, and I think what we're seeing from Trump is that's all that matters, because Trump is an idiot and he has no grasp of how things actually work. The presidency is hugely important, but it's mostly because of the people around the president, especially when it's somebody like Trump.
Yeah, no, that is absolutely right. And look, somebody, I mean, it's the opposite of, right, when I said I was nervous about Buttigieg's candidacy, right? One of the reasons I gave was the, you know, Michael Lewis, the fifth risk, that, you know, it putting somebody who's only ever run a tiny hamlet in the middle of the middle of nowhere in charge of the federal government, when there's so much behind the scenes work to do, you know, seems like a mistake. Obviously, I thought Liz Warren was sort of the most wonkiest roll up your sleeves and, you know, get stuff done. You know, that's also very, very true of Biden. And again, look, like Biden was right just above Marianne Williamson for both of us. Right. neither of us were huge fans of Biden's candidacy.
He was absolutely my last choice of the serious candidates.
Yeah, that's right. And mine, too. And that's where we are. But we do need to acknowledge that, like, right, if you're going to say one of the minuses is he's 175 years old, is, yeah, here's somebody who understands the workings of government intimately and is in a good position to say, oh, yeah, like, I know what's important in terms of staffing executive agencies and, you know, getting stuff done. So I think that fairness sort of requires you to say that. So anyway,
I think it's time to thank our all-time greats. What do you think?
I would love to do that. Can I start?
Top patrons, our Hall of Famers here on, what is it, Top Patron Tuesday?
Top Patron Tuesday, yeah.
You know what, Andrew? You can start. I'm going to say you can start.
All right. And these are our Hall of Famers over at patreon.com/law. We really, really appreciate it. And I love being able to read this every week, especially how creative our patrons are with changing their name. So here we go. Thank you to No Borders Beauty, DynamiteResumes.com, listening on opposite days so it counts as legal advice. but the opposite of that is true, so it doesn't. So there you go. You're stuck. Mike Hall, Newton Mychill. I don't know if that's a berry, but you put the Lysol in the Ronavirus, drink them both up. That's a great. This episode brought to you by the letter Q for quarantine. Samuel Bland, fly like a hot dog freedom eagle. Angry Macface, Tao. Ben Helquist, it's Tuesday, everyone, just in case you lost track.
Oh yeah, gosh. No,
that's an important
still
reminder.
A good patron name.
Yep. Penelope, I screwed it up right off the bat. Penelope Thippins, precocious polyphonic pronouns. This Patreon name is a lot more pressure than I was expecting. Relax, chill, it's all good. In Illinois, we pronounce it Illinois. Big McLarge Huge. Silk at appearslegit.com. There is nothing you can name us that is anything like mandamus. Judge Judy's executioner. Ziegenhagen, oi, oi, oi. The venerable Richard Milhouse Nixon, yeah, good friend of the show. Ian Buckley, they cannot arrest a husband and wife for the same crime. Kristen Daniel, time has lost all meaning. Murray Gregerson, Jake Braun, Colleen Wilson, Christopher Brown, Lawful Copter, can we get cert to appeal all of Thomas's incorrect T3BE answers? Support the co-op economy. No, I don't want to be Dwayne Dibley. Let me be totally clear. Torres Smith 2024. Well, let's hope not. Andrew reviews all Tiger King law. Well, I'd love to know who that Andrew is. Clear eyes, full hearts, totally clear. Zirkle, self-isolation gave me time to finish Pornhub. Barry McCockiner, the unprecedented, resented, demented president defenestrated. Ad Astra, Odin is a truth-telling, dog-faced law dog. Emily Rainbow Spence, whose peas, her peas, whose peas, her peas. And that is, you know, her as the possessive pronoun there. It's pointless to be mad about the status quo if you won't vote out Trump. Wow, that is just a lovely correspondence with these past couple of episodes. Jason Kopus, stocking up on lung injectable bleach. Don't do that. Man Chicken wants to go to a restaurant but doesn't want to kill his neighbors. See, that's a smart allocation of resources. Crushing weight of reality one in this timeline. My blanket, my blue blanket, give me my blue blanket. Almost, but not quite entirely unlike a president. Oh, that is so fantastic. Vegas is a ghost town. Aquaman is the best superhero movie ever. Change my mind. I don't even know.
The Incredibles is the best superhero movie ever.
I think there's a little bit of recency bias, but I think I'm going to go Black Panther. Black Panther's awesome. And the first
Black Panther's good.
Yeah.
I also like Mystery Men better than all of the Marvel movies. So I would go Incredibles, Mystery Men. Let's see. Batman 1989 or whatever.
Yeah. the Christopher Nolan Batman, right?
Yeah.
Good stuff. Other than, and I mean, look, like, I agree, Khal Drogo
was pissed off 70% of our audience.
So Aquaman was great casting, but I think that other than thirst for Khal Drogo, I don't know how defensible that one is. And again, I can't fault your tastes on that. He's a good-looking gentleman. So, Nate Drex, opening arguments, law in front, party in the back, hashtag law mullet. Thomas, I thought I would have a mullet by now based upon the last time I went 7 weeks without cutting my hair.
Your body just grows a mullet. Your body is firmly in the 80s.
Yeah, it's oddly enough, the last time that I did that, I was 19, and my hair grew a little differently back then. So it's weird. Mm. So I'm still woefully short of the mullet. So anyway, Stuff and Polls, Darth Mandy Pants, as always, even when I'm wrong, I'm right. I'm brewing 13th century Saxony gravel truck lawyer V. Frank. Save the U.S. Postal Service. It's indispensable to small businesses. That is 100% correct. Volunteer for your candidate today and take back your government. Jennifer Cratch, remain indoors. Diogenes the Cynic was right. Teresa Chan, wash your hands, then vote for Joe Biden. Agreed. And Jeff Gelbach, take it away, Thomas.
All right, Stephen Balticate Sandoval.
Woo!
My employer is abusing the concept of essential worker. We are going to die. Oh my gosh, sorry to hear that. The Eli Bosnick School of Morality. Happy Cinco de Mayo. Free coronas for everyone. CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. John Bilderback, Fascist Reagan Judges, Andrea the Arbitrary and Capricious, Seattle, home of Westland Distillery, tons of corgis, and OA live shows. Geyer Surgith, me fail presidenting. That's impossible. OA Dance Break, Boots and Katzen, Boots and Katzen. Yeah, nice.
Oh, I did a little dance there with that.
Yeah.
Made a little love, Eric Alvin, got down tonight.
Payne Strumpet. Thomas Smith is my favorite attorney. Andrew is a close second. Trambliss, stay at home, stay the F at home. Thank you. Napoleon, the wandering gambler. Clownhorn, the live show. I just want dinner in Seattle. Milo Meadsong stands in solidarity with UW nurses and their union. Blame Patreon for constantly failing to save profile name changes. Huh. Our 50th best patron. No, sorry. I'm going to blame Patreon for always doing their maintenance the exact time that I post shows.
Or the
Q&A.
They
caught me on Tuesday. Yeah, it's like, come on. Can't you do it in the middle of the night? They do it at 9 my time. And they're a West Coast company. Like, come on. Wait until... anyway. Oh, database maintenance. Really? At 9 p.m.? That's a... okay. Our 50th best patron, John, moderately handsome John, our first and only favorite karaoke legend, Cosmo Blues, join your labor union. Together we bargain, alone we beg. I won't get COVID-19 because I haven't seen COVID's 1 through 18. James Cole, Chicks Juster Fusing. Okay. No. Chad T. Anonymous. Adam Costa. Jay Aldenwalt. It annoys me the title card of the Great British Baking Show is missing a raspberry. Huh. I'm going to have to go check that out. And I know you're a,
I am.
You're a new viewer of that, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Let us get back to us. Do some reporting. WordOrigins.org, your source for legal terms from 13th century Saxony. Do leeches help for coronavirus? Closing concessions, Buttercup's bar exam tutoring, say Clownhorn for 20% off. Don't stand so close to me, 20. Justin, Derek, increasing our patronage for everyone because times are tough. Oh, thank you. Liz somehow became a real-life video game lawyer. Yep, congrats. Master's degree in theoretical phys ed. Big easy blasphemy. This yodeler, or the yodeler, achieved escape velocity and is now in orbit. Rhonda wants an Alaskan live show before it all melts. I picked a hell of a pandemic to quit drinking. Malika Chandler. Poot, quack, and tush. Soggy pants. That also sounds like a beatboxing thing, by the way. Poot, quack, and tush. Poot, quack, and tush. Yeah, no, it doesn't work. It's no boots and cats, but it's close. Soggy pants. David Brooklyn. Greg Sullivan. Matthew Vernon. Adopt a homeless pet and opposed to clawing and ear docking. Don't take ramp building advice from a podcast. Sakashite Fukusumi. 5 years of chaos with Ed Miliband would have just ended. Heather L. Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium, Ian and Ollie, Danny Rosari, Sam Buck, Eli Bosnick, Sam Danow, My Mask Makes Me Look Like Shredder from TMNT, nice, Alexandra Chalupa, aka Natasha Crunchwrap, Mitchell, No Commute, So Behind on Podcasts, yep, a lot of people are, new tagline, Don't Take Medical Advice from President Tide Pod, I agree with that 100%, and finally, Conrad Michaels. All right. It's time to see if my bold gambit on T3BE paid off. It's answer time.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
Talk to the hand. I need your clothes. That's one of my mission parameters. Trust me. I know now why you cry.
Yeah, this was a libertarian protest. Guy enters IRS office. And denounces the income tax, sets fire to pages from his copy of the Internal Revenue Code. Fire is extinguished before it causes any damage. He was charged with violating a state law that prohibited igniting fire in a public building and claimed that his prosecution was unconstitutional under the First Amendment. May he be convicted? You went with the bold answer of definitely yes, eliminating the two no answers. You're like, oh, look, you know, he's lighting a fire inside a government office. Yes, he may be convicted. And your boldness pays off. I love it when your boldness pays off.
I do it all for you, Andrew. Yeah. I just want to impress you.
Great. So then the question is, may he be constitutionally convicted? Either C, yes, because burning the code was conduct rather than speech, or D, yes, because the state law was narrowly drawn to further a substantial government interest in prohibiting the non-communicative aspects of the act in question. And you went with D with a little bit of trepidation. And I want to tell you, D is exactly correct. All so right. Great job. You are.
That was an easy one.
Yeah, you are at 56.3% overall. So trending upwards and 74% in the last 23 questions.
I feel like this new book's easier. Maybe I just got smarter.
Could be both. So. What this question is testing is the Speech Act doctrine. And these are fun cases for law students because some of the seminal cases are, you know, involve like topless dancing and other things that like make you giggle when you're in law school. But basically the idea is that there are aspects of speech that are communicative, even though they're not technically talking. Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we use the example in Friday's episode of, in fact, we used it within the confines of this question. I didn't mean it as a hint, but maybe it was a subconscious one. Right. Bra burning. Right. Like we all know that during the Equal Rights Amendment, during, you know, the debate over equality for women, which rages on to this day, we instantly get why burning a bra is a message. Right. And similarly, like this guy, it's a libertarian kook, but we get why setting fire to a copy of the Internal Revenue Code is a form of political speech, even though fire itself is not talking, right? So the standard under the First Amendment is that you must, one, intend to communicate a message via your act, and two, the audience must be capable of understanding that communication, right? So there is both the subjective component, what did you intend to do, and an objective component. Right. So that way we don't, you know, you don't pave the way for like libertarians being like, well, by not paying my taxes, I was engaged in that. Right. Because, you know, people. So has to fulfill both the subjective you intend, the objective, the audience is likely to understand it. And this seems pretty clearly to fulfill those criteria. When that happens, Then the question is, and you analyzed it under a time, place, and manner restriction, which, again, it's not how
is
it's...
That, yeah, I was going to ask. Is that not quite right?
It's part of... I love that you said that because it's part of reinforcing the fundamental underlying lesson about the show, right? Which is on a law school exam, right? In a law student outline, you would not put this under time, place, and manner cases because this is not a time, place, and manner case. But the same general principles apply, right? Which is to say that so long as the law is neutral, right? It's not targeting the substance of the communication, right? As long as the restrictions are narrowly tailored to further a substantial governmental interest, then they can prohibit stuff that will prohibit the act part of your speech, even though it's reasonable speech act, right? And that's where you came out. You were like, look, yeah, I get it. If he's in the, you know, he's in the park, there are fire extinguishers nearby, you know, hold up and burn the tax code the way you, you know, burn the bra. But inside a government building, probably not a great place to engage in your protest. And that's exactly
how
this
arson comes up. Is okay as long as the fuel you used is like some speech component, like some document that.
Yeah, exactly. This is why, you know, sovereign citizens are always wrong, right? they're looking for
many
that
reasons.
Like, yeah, well, you know, it says this, so therefore, and you're like, look, it doesn't really even matter. So perfect application.
So the point is I was right. I win.
Yeah,
but
you were right for exactly the right reasons. So great
why
job.
Don't you hop in your time machine? Let's find out who this week's big winner is of T3B.
Yeah, and I'm gonna pick somebody who actually won here, unless there's another MC Hammer reference that I can't pass up.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
All right, Thomas, this week's winner is Rick Ellis on Twitter, who says, accidentally burning down the building would indeed send a message, but that doesn't mean it's protected speech, not even if the building also contains a payday lender. So, great, exactly right, and nice job getting a jab in there at payday lenders, who are, as we all know, scumbags. So, congratulations, Rick Ellis. Everyone give him a follow on Twitter. That is at ELLRIC, the Rick Ellis on Twitter with the correct answer. Congratulations on being this week's winner.
All right. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. We love you, and we will see you for a rapid response Friday.
See you then.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. Podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is a copyrighted production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our transcriptionist, Heather Leverage, production assistant, Ashley Smith, and with the generous assistance of our volunteer unofficial researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our merch and our live shows and also heads up the OA Wiki project. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian, and Teresa. Check out the Opening Arguments community on Facebook. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the fabulous OA theme song, which is used with permission.